shooting from the lip.
We're taking no prisoners here. Real opinions for real people.
John Gaunt, shooting from the lip.
Hi, good afternoon, and welcome to another edition of Shooting from the Lip with me, John Gaunt, on Sputnik International. I've got a fantastic guest for you today, Neil Wallace, Fleet Street legend. He has edited the major tabloids. He's a social commentator. You'll see him reviewing the papers. You'll even see him on Newsnight sometimes. And he always shoots from the lip. And I think he's apt to talk to somebody who's part of the media. In the light of the Jeremy Kyle saga, Danny Baker, we're going to talk about Brexit, we're going to talk about Donald Trump and Sadiq Khan, and of course we're going to talk about Theresa May and the phenomenon that is Nigel Farage.
Shooting from the lip.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Good afternoon, John.
Incredible times. Let's get on to the politics later. Let's start, though, by talking about the Jeremy Kyle scandal. What do you make of it?
Well, I've long been very uncomfortable about the whole Jeremy Kyle type programme. I've never watched it and not shivered, really. It's a straightforward rip-off of a guy who used to run a similar sort of programme in America, actually, in Chicago, former mayor of Chicago. Can't remember his name off the top of my head. I'm sure you probably will, because he came over here for a bit, actually.
Yeah, I know you mean. The guy with the glasses, he slips my mind as well. Jerry Springer. They made a musical about him, but go on, carry on.
That's it, and they made a musical out of it.
That's right, yeah. One day it'll be you, Neil.
He had a sense of wit about him, actually. Whereas I found Jeremy Kyle, I was never comfortable with it. I thought it was unremittingly grim. And I sort of thought it pretty much symbolised much of daytime television, really.
So it was right to take it off after the apparent suicide of this man?
Was it right to take it? What a good question. If there is a connection, and we're assuming that there is a connection.
We don't know because there's not been a coroner's report yet.
Exactly. I'm very, very wary about knee-jerk reactions. I mean, I'm sure we'll come on to talk about the other case in a minute, but I'm very, very wary of knee-jerk reactions without waiting to see what the official verdict is. You know, maybe there were intrinsic problems with the programme, because I would have thought it was perfectly reasonable to say people who went on something like that needed to be pretty carefully vetted, because this was always a potential issue. You know, I'd prefer to wait for the results of the inquiries rather than... It makes you wonder, doesn't it, whether they were looking for a reason to terminate it, frankly.
Well, when we go on to Danny Baker, I might bring that back up. But just let's stay on Kyle for a moment. What about the argument that Piers Morgan, of course, mate of yours, has put forward this morning, which is no one gets forced to go on there? And how different is it to what you used to do in the tabloids, Neil?
Totally right. Totally agree. Nobody has to do these things. Nobody has to give you interviews. It's always a little too convenient for the sort of left-wing and right-on PC rent-a-mob to instantly point the figure and to go holier than thou and begin their constant virtue signaling. And I think that Piers has got a very, very valid point there. My doubt about it was, as I say, I was never comfortable watching it. I never watched it voluntarily. You know, I used to read the tabloids, then my rivals, now I'm just a customer, but I used to read them voraciously and I was fascinated by it. And I always took the view, you know, I've interviewed so many people more times than not on what used to be called death knocks, when you used to go to the home of somebody who'd suffered a bereavement. Very often they were actually glad to meet you, because nobody talked to them about these things, and the powers that be are as sort of warm and as open very often as the bricks on the wall. So I never, ever bought into this idea that it was always intrusive. It's simply not true.
That's something I want to bring up with you, because I was talking about this today with Lisa, my missus, and she said, well, there's a lot of snobbiness towards Jeremy Kyle. I'll declare an interest. I know him. I like him. I think he's a good guy. But she said this man, Kyle, what he does is he does a form of therapy. hear me out before you laugh, a form of therapy for working class people which they can't afford to buy or they would never get from anywhere else. It's all about them getting to resolutions. And I think there's something in that.
I think there is something in it, but I thought that it had gone past that point too. Whenever I saw it, it did feel to me as though it had gone on from there to be pure gladiators in the arena and, you know, Christians thrown to the lions, etc. I may be unfair on this, John. I was never comfortable with it. And I think that, you know, if Lisa has seen it more recently than I have, and, you know, she's a good, honest, straightforward, straight talker, she will probably have a more nuanced view of it than I would, but I couldn't watch it very much.
Okay, Danny Baker, let's have your nuanced view on that. I think he was hung out to dry. I know Danny as well. I worked with him for 6.5 years. He hasn't got a racist bone in his body. What do you make of what happened?
Lovely, lovely, lovely man. I don't know whether he might have had the odd tipple before he sent what he thought was funny. And what I hated about it was when I read his explanation about, you know, it was, if you like, almost the first sort of Mickey-taking image he came across to sort of point at the rich and powerful playing the media game, and that it could just as easily have been something totally innocuous that couldn't have begun any million years to be considered racist. And I absolutely believed him. I totally believed him. I don't know him hardly at all, but I have met him. He's just not that guy. He's just not that sort of guy. And I thought that it was just classic BBC. We've got an issue. How can we resolve it? I know. Let's take the coward's way out. Let's make ourselves look holier than thou. And they threw him to the wolves.
Yeah, that said, but he may not be a racist guy, but he must have been a bit thick to use a monkey and not know that Meghan Markle was mixed race and not know there is a connection between the way some people depict black people and monkeys. I mean, he knows about that, doesn't he? We all know.
Yeah, everybody knows that. But, John, my point was, I'm not sure now. I can't exactly remember the time of day he sent it. I just wondered whether he was
pissed.
How can I put it? whether or not he might have had an odd drink and not thought about it.
So he doesn't deserve to be sacked as far as you're concerned for that?
No, I didn't think so. I thought he should have been wrapped over the knuckles. I think you could have suspended him. And you know, you compare it with when they sacked that idiot Brand for what he was got together with Jonathan Ross. I mean, it's just nothing. It's just not comparable, is it? You know, he either made a very bad taste joke or a colossal error of judgment. It was a disgraceful thing to send. But, you know, sometimes things happen in haste or in error. You don't get hung like a sheep or a lamb simply for making what was a bad error.
But are both of these cases then examples of where social media, Twitter in particular now, and the Twitterati, the mob, the witch hunt, have got too much power?
Oh, totally. Totally. And but you know what, though, John? You know as well as I do. They have a power that is given to them. And if the BBC have given them this power. Not only that, I'll tell you something else. The BBC have made themselves huge hostages to fortune. How do they not to immediately sack without any sort of discussion or debate anybody else who crosses some sort of line, whether it's deliberate or accidental? Where does the sort of sentencing begin or end? You know, is everything a capital offence?
I've been saying this for ages. The Twitter mob have appointed themselves as the new Lord Chamberlains. What do you reckon?
Well, again, only because people like the BBC, and again, worse in my opinion, is the social media giants of Facebook, Google, etc., who decided they will censor and decide what to censor on social media. They will decide what is unacceptable. They will decide what is right-wing or alt-right or terrorist-supporting. These are people who quite happily put ISIS videos of beheadings and murders and executions online. And now they've suddenly decided to point themselves as the moral arbiters. I'm sorry, I think it's the same kind of thing. You know, who actually makes these decisions? I didn't appoint them.
Yeah, but hold on a minute. Are you not just jealous because you represent the tabloid press and the tabloid press used to have this power? Your power has diminished and the power of social media has massively increased. You're just jealous.
Well, the first two bits of those are right. The power of the tabloid press has diminished and the power of the social media has massively increased. So you're right on both of those things. But what you know as well, I know you've been deliberately provocative there, is that the tabloid media, whether or not people choose to accept it or not, were in fact quite tightly controlled by a press standards authority and are still are. And they can be hauled over the coals and are when they transgress. And everybody makes mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. We should never forget that. Everybody, not everybody gets it right all the time. You know, the high moral tone of The Guardian, for instance, about things like Julian Assange, etc. Never forget that the Guardian was a newspaper that had got a young informant who worked in the Ministry of Defence, I think it was, sent to jail because they named their source to a leak rather than got taken to court years ago. I'm very nervous about anybody who makes themselves, you know, judge and jury. And the tabloid press, frankly, are not judge and jury. They have their own judge and jury hanging over them. It's called IPSO. It's called the Independent Press Standards Authority, organization rather. And periodically people say organizations like that are not strong enough. But frankly, self-regulation has worked, does work, and in fact, it's gone the other way now. They're far too safe.
You can't be in favour, though, of regulation of the internet, can you? I mean, how practical is it? And isn't that dangerous in itself? Because then governments can decide what we can see.
John, my point was, if you remember a moment ago, was if there is going to be regulation, and I don't see how there can be, frankly, it certainly shouldn't be down to a bunch of yuppies, PC yuppies, living in Silicon Valley in California, deciding huge, huge issues. I've no truck for Tommy Robinson, for instance, but really some 20-odd-year-old guy in California is deciding he's not acceptable. Really? Do we give that guy that power? Did you vote for that?
No, I don't think I should have that power. But the other thing about just mentioning Tommy Robinson, I thought Johnny Mercer was completely out of order when he said, oh, it was only a milkshake. There could have been acid in that milkshake. It's not fair for anyone who's standing for election, in a legitimate election, which, of course, Tommy Robinson is, to be attacked in that manner. Do you agree? We all remember Prescott on the egg and Corbyn in the egg. What's your view?
Precisely. I mean, you know, the guy is standing in an election. He's a legitimate candidate. And the answer to Tommy Robinson is very easy. I either vote for him or don't vote for him. But if he's entitled to legally stand, then he should be treated just the same as Theresa May or Johnny Mercer or even John Gaunt if he stood for election.
There's no chance of that happening, let me tell you. Listen, it's interesting you mentioned Theresa May. We're going to move on to her in a moment. We're going to talk about Chukwuma and we've got to talk about Nigel Farage. I think we'll start with him and we'll talk about the Andrew Marr interview, which seems to have sparked so much trouble. And of course, that was on the BBC, the impartial BBC. So we'll get Neil Wallace's view on that. You're listening to the... I can't wait for him to talk about Sadiq Khan as well and Trump's visit. This is Shooting from the Lip. This is John Gaunt. My special guest this week, Neil Wallace.
Shooting from the Lip.
Welcome back to the second part of Shooting from the Lip with me, John Gaunt, with Fleet Street legend as my special guest this week, Neil Wallace. Right, Neil, let's get straight into it. Let's talk about Nigel Farage and his, you know, what he's doing, what an impact it is in a moment. But let's first of all talk about that Andrew Marr interview. I watched it on playback much later in the day, and I was fuming. I have never seen such a biased interview. And on the very day, of course, which Brian Walden passed away, you think, is this where we've got to with the BBC and politics?
Yes, I must confess, I didn't watch it either. But early on Sunday morning for me, that. What you sort of felt when you watched it was every cliche about how the BBC have become sort of frozen in time and frozen on one side of a debate, how they've lost the ability to move and assess and react accordingly to the moving political times. I mean, you know, you watch Question Time like I do. Week in, week out, it's 4-1 pro-Remain. And that's because the BBC have always traditionally, on Question Time, had a Tory, had a Labour, had a Liberal, had another political, and then Joe Soap. Occasionally it's been me, it's been you a couple of times, I think. But politics aren't like that anymore. Politics at the moment, I hope it goes back to the old ways, frankly, but politics now is about Brexit. Politics in this country is about Leave or Remain. And Question Time, one of the most important programmes on the BBC, is frozen in time. Well, similarly, that's what happened with Andrew Marr. And I tweeted a lot about this because I like Andrew Marr. I like him as a person. I like him, his programme. I like the idea of his programme. But that was a joke. And, you know, Farage was completely justified in sitting there at the helm of a massive political phenomenon. What you are seeing maybe is the destruction of the two-party system. What you are seeing is a revolution happening in front of your eyes. What you are seeing is nothing less than a phenomenon. And that surely was enough to talk about how he's able to do this. For instance, at some point, Marr, if you remember, suddenly threw in, you've even attracted somebody who used to be a revolutionary communist. Quite rightly, Farage says, absolutely right. So how did that happen? Why aren't we talking about that? Instead of you asking me about something I said in a throwaway line in an interview with GQ magazine years ago.
But the point is, surely we have to be able to ask politicians about things they've said in the past. Are you just saying then the balance was wrong? And was the balance wrong because, I don't know, Andrew Marr was after the kill? He was after the big stitch-up?
I think that he did two things. I think the balance absolutely was wrong. But I thought that it seemed to me was more that they weren't treating Farage and the Brexit Party with the proper amount of gravitas. They just saw this as, oh, it's a UKIP flare-up Mark II. It's all going to be full of silly, loose wackos, as UKIP was originally. We've both been, you know, side with disappointment and astonishment at some of the things that, you know, UKIP and the people who were involved with UKIP at the time. It has morphed into something very different. And accordingly, some very sharp political analysts at the BBC should have seen that and treated it in that way. They don't talk to Chukwuemeka and Anna Soubry in that way, do they? That's not how they go after them. And they treated basically Farage in that programme, it seemed to me, like a freak show and went after that.
And did you think that actually it's just going to increase his popularity? So I thought he answered the questions well. I think it was biased, and I think, therefore, that will only help Nigel.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think he called it out well and at the right time and in the right way. You know, I think an awful lot of people watching that, let me tell you from my experience, I've discovered before that people who watch those early Sunday morning programs, because I've been on a few, tend to be the very people who are now looking and thinking, you know what, I'm not going to vote Tory. I'm not going to vote traditional Labour like I have done for, you know, decades. I think I might give this a go because what he's saying is right. And, you know, that's their core audience. And I thought they got it spectacularly wrong.
So was that because of institutionalised bias in the BBC?
To a certain extent, I think that's right. I think that, do you remember when the BBC eventually caved in and did an internal inquiry into their treatment of Eurosceptics? Actually, you're right. We have been biased against it. We've not taken it seriously. Then they had the same issue about Israel when there was a lot of constant complaints about the sort of slant of their portrayal of Israel. And they protested against it, went away and came back, says, actually, you've got a fair point. And we're going to have to do something. Not that they have, actually. I don't think about Israel, but that's a separate issue. But I think that there is what you can't get away from. If you're a senior at the BBC, you are not like you or me. You are not basically jumped up working class blokes who've made something of themselves. In the main, they are the metro elite. They are the soft, liberal, university educated, overwhelmingly privately educated, very right on people who don't see the world like they see it in Barnsley or Beaconsfield or outside the London bubble. And that shows time after time after time.
OK, well, in a minute, I want to talk about why Farage is being successful. But let's just finish with the BBC. Did an interview like that make the absolute inevitability of the BBC licence fee being cut or slashed or got rid of become nearer?
No, I don't think so. Again, you have to temper this sort of stuff. The BBC is still a fantastic institution. The BBC does an amazing job very often in very, very many areas. And you've got to be careful about throwing the baby out with the bathwater, to use a cliche. I think it has some big issues, though. I think it has consistently got the whole Euroscepticism and particularly Brexit wrong. There's only one person who has taken Brexit seriously and gives it a serious crack of the whip, and that, of course, is Andrew Neil. But otherwise, overwhelmingly, the start point is they are sceptic about Euroscepticism. You've only got to listen to almost any of the daytime programmes on Radio 4. Do you ever listen to them?
I do, or listen to or watch any of the comedy shows. There's never anybody who's joking the other way.
Yeah, and that seems to be all right. It's all right to go on there pumping out this message of, let's be right about it, I'm no fan of Theresa May. But just the consistently anti-Tory, anti-right of centre, pro-PC virtue signalling till it makes you vomit from, you know, these young hipster comics. They pump out it out day in, date out, and it's insidious.
OK, let's move away from the media and the BBC and let's now concentrate on the Brexit Party. How well are they going to do? And what has Nigel Farage got right this time? And have you ever, in all of your career in newspapers, seen anything like this?
What he's got right is he has so far, at least, and I hope to goodness this continues, he's kept away the nutty fringe. I think he's done that very well. I think he sort of started UKIP and it drifted along. And for a long time, he was just grateful of any support that came towards him. This was pre the referendum. And I think that it did damage him. He was seen to basically get in bed with anybody to get a vote. I think, though, that he, just like he galvanised UKIP before the election that frightened Cameron.
Yeah, 2015, wasn't it?
That he galvanised UKIP so well then that it terrified the establishment. Well, I think what's happened here is he gave out various kinds of warnings, didn't he, that they wouldn't mean it after the referendum. And he's been proved right. And so many people, so many people now have looked in initial disbelief and then in shock. And now my fear, in outright anger and rage at the way that Brexit has just been thrown away.
Well, he's just done what Trump's done, hasn't he? He's got on top of that disaffected vote. Is he our Trump? I mean, he's going to win the European elections, but could this go further? What do you reckon, Neil?
I don't think he can be our Trump because Trump blatantly appeals to some very viscerally nasty sides to the world. I don't think those moods are in Britain. I don't think there is the sense of anger, of impotence, if you like, impotent anger against other parties, against over other issues, as there is over Brexit. Again, it comes back to that thing, John, the establishment have created Nigel Farage because the establishment have spat in the eye of ordinary, decent people, whether they're working class, middle class or whoever, whether they're black or white or wherever they are from, whichever part of the country, they have spat in their eye and say, we know better than you. And Farage has stood up and he's saying this very sensibly, very calmly. He is saying, I told you that they would betray you. They are betraying you, and we have to make this happen. And the only way you can do this is vote for me. And he's been very, very careful.
Okay, so when he wins the European elections, which we all know he's going to do, what does it mean for Theresa May and Corbyn? They've been trying to stitch up this deal. How do you see this playing out?
Believe it or not, next week, the Parliament is going on yet another recess, which just happens to coincide with the European elections and the aftermath of them. So I suspect she'll be hoping that it'll give her a bit of breathing space away from, with all the MPs away from Westminster. I don't think it will give her that. It will just be a further incentive to, for them to get rid of a woman who is without question the worst prime minister this country has ever seen. I think she is now even worse than David Cameron.
Yeah, it is. But let me just ask you a question. Is this the end of two-party politics? Could Farage, in a general election, and there's going to be one soon, obviously, is he going to hold the reins of power, the balance of power? What do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, I would counsel you against the idea that there will be a general election soon. I think neither of the major parties will want that. They're both terrified of the after effects on this. And I think they will try to last out the full 5 years. I think that the Labour Party will only produce a vote of no confidence if they're confident that they will fail it, that they will lose, because they will not want to go to the polls. Would you want to go to the polls in South Yorkshire as a Labour MP? There's a very good piece, which I recommend to you, which I'm sure you've read, in the Daily Telegraph today about someone who's been on the road with Farage. They were in a working men's club rally in somewhere like Halifax. It wasn't Halifax, but it was somewhere like Halifax. A constituency that I'll tell you where it was. It was Yvette Cooper's, somewhere near Pontefract, to Yvette Cooper's constituency. And this is a constituency that would vote Labour for a donkey. They have never voted Conservative in their life. And this journalist from the Telegraph was with them, and Farage stood up, and Widdicombe stood up. They cheered Anne Widdicombe. Anne Widdicombe, the arch Tory for years and years and years, cheered her to the rafters. Then Nigel Farage came onto them chanting his name. This is in ferocious, lifelong Labour territory. And during the interview, the woman talks to people, and they're spitting the name of Yvette Cooper. You know, are you going to want to risk taking them to a general election? I think Farage will win the Europeans easily. What he's got to then do is become more and considered. And again, in this piece I read at the weekend about how he has completely changed the team around him from the sort of ragbag he used to have. And it's much more professional political people now. He's got to produce a manifesto that takes into account the fact he's got to remain a credible right-of-centre party, a radical populist party. And that will be his challenge. But I tell you what, I think there's a real chance that we are seeing the end of the two-party system. Do we want that if it's going to mean Chuckaramuna and his chums of Change UK? Change UK, which only policy, it seems to me, is they want to remain exactly the same.
And on that note, Neil, we have to leave it there. But thank you for joining me. That's Neil Wallace, the Fleet Street legend. They call him the Wolfman of Fleet Street. I'm sure he's got you thinking. Let's hear your views on it as well. I'll be back next week with another edition of Shooting From The Lip with another guest who's not afraid to say it as it is and to shoot from that lip. Thanks for listening.
Shooting From The Lip.
If you've got a view, I want to hear it. If you agree, I want to hear it. If you disagree, get in touch. Tell me why I'm wrong, but you better have a good argument.
This is Shooting From The Lip.